Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we explore different aspects of the world of music, including music history. So I bring to you Follow the Sounds this week in music history. Of course, we are going December 11th through December 15th, a very short, good little weekday segment of music history. And another thing, if you want to help out the show, of course, you can do so by going to our website and clicking on the Amazon banner on the right-hand side. That's followthesoundpodcast.com. It'll take you to Amazon. You can do all of your normal shopping, and anything that you buy there, we get a little bit of money just for you guys going through our website, and it won't cost you anything extra. So go to the website and click on that banner, or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Also, I'm pretty sure if you click on it once, it just keeps loading back up again. So you don't have to worry about it even after that. So I'm just saying, like, it's a really easy thing to do. Also want to thank lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do the show, because that's what they do. They put on podcasts, and you can usually go and find something there at lineupmedia.fm that you can enjoy to listen to besides our great and wonderful podcast. And, you know, I mean, tons of different subjects that are covered, multiple shows, just tons and tons of stuff. Just go there, check it out, find something else that you like. Because studies have shown that if you listen to one podcast, you're more likely to listen to at least five others. So there you go. Ours happens to be number one on your list, of course. So hopefully, you know, you're going out and you can find other great shows to listen to on lineupmedia.fm. So I am your host, Brian Kroc, and along with me tonight to help me out in this great venture through the world of music history is Jacob Crum.
Make believe you don't see the tears.
Ben Schaefer.
Hello.
And Greg Harvey.
Ben stole mine.
He did?
You can say hi.
That's true. He does say hi a lot. But, you know, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, everybody says hi at least
salutations.
A few times. Salutations. You've said salutations before. I know you have.
Yes, and so. Konnichiwa.
Yeah. Either way, we ourselves are just a young group of guys talking about things that happened well before we were born for the most part. But who cares? We like this kind of stuff because we like music history. So let's get this entire week started off on December 11th. Jacob Crum, what do you got for me?
1954, Jermaine Jackson is born in Gary, Indiana, fourth in line in the Jackson dynasty. Can anyone else here other than me name any Jermaine Jackson tracks?
No.
ABC.
I could tell you the ones listed on this piece of paper in front
of
me.
Have you heard any of them?
No.
Nope.
Oh, my God. You have not heard Let's Get Serious.
I mean, I don't know.
Oh, it's a great song. My personal favorite, however, is Dynamite.
Okay.
All night, you supply the spark. Intense, high-explosive dynamite. Pure dynamite. Boom goes
wow.
the dynamite.
You do that on karaoke night.
He does do karaoke nights.
No, especially
I bring
the
house
song.
Down.
I'm sure you do. With dynamite.
Mm-hmm. One of these days, I'm going to smash up some DJ equipment afterwards.
You're also Burning Hot when you do it, too.
Burning Hot's a good song. There's another one called...
We should go to a karaoke night and just do explosive-themed songs. So I'll do TNT by AC/DC.
That's cool.
TNT.
I'll do Dynamite by Tyo Cruz.
Anyway, happy birthday, Jermaine Jackson.
Nicely done. Moving on up. On December 11th, 1960, Aretha Franklin plays her first concert performing at the Village Vanguard in New York City. Now, of course, she grew up singing in the church, so this is not exactly her first concert, but it was her first, like, real solo show as a pop artist. And I just wanted to let you know that she probably walked in there. Maybe a few people knew who she was. And she brought the house down, because that's what Aretha Franklin does. She is the queen of soul. It is that simple. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. She dominates that space and will forever dominate that space for the rest of time. Thank you.
All right, Aretha.
Aretha will always be one of my favorite singers, female singers of all time. Like, the second I heard her, In the Blues Brothers movie, I was floored. Done. It was all over after that. And every single thing that I've heard after that from her just amazes me. So there you go. Jake, I'm tossing it back to you.
All right. 1964, Sam Cooke is killed at the Hacienda Motel in Los Angeles.
Yes.
You a Sam Cooke fan, Brian?
Huge Sam Cooke fan. I've been talking about doing, we need to do a Sam Cooke review.
Oh, yeah.
Artist review, not an album review, because I've got like a couple of his greatest hits and stuff, but there's a couple of his songs that are still just some of my all-time favorite songs. Cupid, I love that song. Always loved that song.
Chain Gang.
Chain Gang was always a great one. His rendition of Old Man River is amazing. Like, I will sometimes just go back and watch that video over and over again because of the way he sings it is just brilliant. So I love his voice.
World.
Yeah.
That's when it gets me.
Sam Cooke could not do a bad song, in my opinion. He had an incredible voice and was so, so good and so talented. And that's why it's a very sad day that he got knocked out like this.
You know any of the backstory of his death?
Yes, I do. But please enlighten our listeners.
It is so strange and interesting. So to talk about Sam Cooke, we need to talk about three women. The hotel owner of the Hacienda Hotel in Los Angeles at the time was Evelyn Carr.
Mm-hmm.
The manager of the hotel was Bertha Franklin. And a guest of Sam Cooke that night was Elsa Boyer. Now, LAPD received a call from the hotel owner, Evelyn Carr. She told them that she was on the phone with her hotel manager, Bertha Franklin, that night, and that she heard a man screaming at Bertha. Sounded like there was a struggle and a gunshot. And then Bertha did not come back to the phone. So she requested that they go and check it out. When they arrived, they found Sam Cooke on the floor, dead, wearing only a sports coat and a shoe.
Okay.
All right. When they questioned Bertha as to what happened, she said Sam Cooke had broken into her office, demanded to see the woman that he had come to the hotel with, and would not leave, and that he then assaulted Bertha, and she shot him and then beat him with a broomstick until he died. The police did not buy that story, and they arrested her that night. Okay. They also received another call from Elsa Boyer. They found her on the street at a payphone with Sam Cooke's clothes shoved under a bush and $108 in his wallet. She told him that Sam had that she had accompanied him home from a restaurant, that they had gone up to his hotel room, that he had removed all her clothes, assaulted her, attempted to rape her, then took a break from raping her to use the bathroom. And she scooped up her clothes and inadvertently some of his clothes and ran into the street and phoned the police immediately. They also did not buy her story and at that night did not even write it as a report.
Wow.
However, during the subsequent investigation, they went to the restaurant where Sam Cooke and Elsa were having dinner and talked to the bar patrons and the restaurant staff. And they told her that they told the police that Elsa was a known prostitute who openly discussed prices with people at the bar and also talked to the bartender and bragged about how she would steal money from her Johns on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
So now in questioning Evelyn Carr, she told them that she had heard Sam yell, "I know she's here. I want to see her." And then after the gunshot, heard Sam say, "You shot me, lady."
Well.
Right. They investigated. Now, the police investigations never crossed over between the reported rape from Elsa and Bertha's shooting. The grand jury did not indict her. They did not. They took it as self-defense. However, the story gets a little strange because his family did not live in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So to identify the body at the coroner's office, Eda James went down to identify the body.
Yes.
And Eda James has said constantly that she believes that Sam Cooke was murdered by at least two of those women, if not three, because he was crazy beaten in the face. Not something you would do. You could probably manage with a broomstick. And that his hands were so mangled, it looks like every bone in his hands were crushed. Now, I don't know that Eda James is an expert at like post-mortem
I will tell you this. Okay, so Eda James, she is a woman
yes.
who definitely did not live an easy life.
That's true.
The fact she probably had not only seen multiple men, like, and women beaten senselessly, she had probably beaten a few of them herself. She probably knew her way around what a beat up person looked like. And she probably would know, like, I mean, you can tell when a hand is very mangled. So I would not put it past her at all that she's completely telling the truth.
I have
also Etta James had no reason to lie. So,
well, I mean,
she already has money. She already had fame. Right. She already had everything. She didn't know Sam though. What? I mean, she knew him.
So I'm not saying she has incentive to lie, but you know, there's a cognitive dissonance of not wanting to believe that your friend is.
Yes, that's true.
You know, a bad person. However, I have not read the transcript from the grand jury or from the the grand jury indictments. So I'm not an expert on this case, but I mean, it like starts to sound like Sam Cooke got murdered.
Yeah,
like kind of without question.
I completely agree. I've always thought that he you know was murdered as opposed to some weird self-defense thing or something like that. So just from what I thought of when I read the facts themselves. So I agree. Either way, it is still a sad day for music because you know, we lost such a talented human with an incredible voice.
At age 33, no.
Yeah, he was very young. So, but let's go ahead and move on up 1 year in the future. Greg, all you.
The year was 1961. Motown Records scores their first number one on the Hot 100 when the Marvelettes release Please, Mr. Postman, topping the chart.
Please, Mr. Postman, look and see.
Yes, Motown, that Detroit sound.
So, yes, here's I've always liked that song. And that song, of course, was written by Smokey Robinson. And Smokey Robinson, like, wrote it, brought a bunch of people in after they recorded it and said, hey, what do you guys think of these different songs that we recorded? And he said when they put on Please Mr. Postman, like the room exploded and they loved it. And he was just like, got myself the hit. And that's exactly what happened. Went on to become number one, of course, on the Hot 100. Sold a bunch of copies and literally put Motown on the map. After that, they started cranking out hits. So there you go. Kicked off what would become a dynasty.
Oh,
as far as music is concerned. So.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. Not a whole lot happened with the Marvelettes after that, though. Like, a lot of the other Motown artists, like, really picked up. The Marvelettes had, like, you know, kind of a, they Please Mr. Postman, and then it was like, yeah, you know, whatever. Because, like, later on, like, the Supremes came out, you know, and, like, that kind of stuff, so.
I am a firm believer that whoever does it first gets the least amount of credit in the arts a lot of times. Specifically in music, because you have an artist that starts the new sound.
Yeah.
And then it's the second, third, and fourth bands that come out that make it big. Because everybody's like, what is this with the first one? They get used to it. Then the next group comes out, drops a bunch of singles. Everybody's feeling it at that point. And that's why you get, you know, those follow-up bands. I genuinely think that's true.
Case in point, Sex Pistols and the Ramones both said the New York Dolls were their influences.
Right. That's a great example.
And yet most people don't know about the New York Dolls, but they know about the Sex Pistols, and they know about the Ramones.
That is a good example.
You know, you see that more in hip-hop than I think any other genre.
That is true.
Because, like, nobody talks about Curtis Blow anymore. And, like, Curtis Blow was, like, the first person to do so much in the rap game.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, with samples. And I mean, Sugar Hill was the first, like, people to track, but then they dropped off after that. But Curtis Blow, anyway.
Well, I mean, even somebody like the Sugar Hill Gang, like you're getting it, like you were alluding to, they are still credited as being kind of like the first hip hop group out there. But as far as success goes, it was the people. I mean, the genre didn't exist in a sense.
Yeah.
They created it, and then other people got, you know, just enormously big from it.
Yep.
And you know, that's just kind of how it goes.
Completely agree.
Okay.
Moving on up to 1965 to close out the day, the Velvet Underground play their first show, opening for a group called The Middle Class, spelled with a Y, because that's what they did. They played at the auditorium of Summit High School in New Jersey and played three songs, including There She Goes Again, Heroin, and Venus in Furs.
What was that one about?
Heroin?
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably about a superhero.
And drugs.
I'm just saying. But yeah, no, Velvet Underground, of course, the great band that influenced a thousand other bands and yet really could not be duplicated. So there you go. I dig it. I like how I picked the two that are like the first concerts, you know. But it is also kind of amazing that Aretha Franklin starts out in 60 playing her first. Then 5 years later, the Velvet Underground. It's like also like in the same vicinity. Just that cracks me up.
Dude, that like government crackdown on rock and roll in the late 50s, like like 59 to 61, really opened the door for new artists to show up.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that long before you had just insane.
Yeah. Especially in the New York era, yeah. You know, in that era, like, you know, it would have been a lot of people just showing up. And I always think about it. It's like I hear about the great people that came out of that and the great bands that came out of it. But I keep thinking, how many other bands were there that like nobody ever heard about, that like never got famous, never got radio play, maybe never even made an album? It's like, how many other bands were out there?
Well, we've got one.
It's like, because
middle class.
Yes, that's true. It's like, because I mean, when I was recently up there, like I was thinking about this because I went to a show to see like, you know, a jazz band play. And I'm just like, there's got to be like 100 different clubs where people are playing jazz right now in like a 30-mile radius of where I am. Like, if not more. Like, just tons and tons of places where music is being played. And these are some top-notch musicians. I'm just like, and yet nobody outside of this area would ever know who these people are. Just it floored me. It's like, I don't know. It's a weird thought, you know. It's like, how many other bands didn't make it when you hear about, you know, these punk bands or hip hop groups or, you know, whatever it happens to be. Like, it's just a funny thought, that's all. If somebody knows that answer, you're a genius and let me know. So you can find us on Facebook at Follow the Sound. If you search for us, you can find our group. We try to interact as much as possible with the people who comment on there. And we're always sharing videos and other different things about music and as well as our shows. So there you go. But we are moving on to December 12th.
1901, Guglielmo Marconi receives the first transatlantic radio signal.
Yes.
1901, 116 years ago. Today.
Yes.
That's not that long.
So, of course, this also spawned the famous Marconi Awards.
Yes.
Which, but who really invented radio?
That was not Marconi.
Yeah, there's three people up for that.
Marconi, the weird Russian guy, hang on. I have to go through my bad 80s hair metal
bands.
Well,
he's not Russian, he's German, but okay. Braun, and then there's DeForest.
Tesla.
Yeah, you could kind of. So radio is really interesting because you have a lot of scientists over, even before Marconi.
Mm-hmm.
You have Hertz.
Yes.
You know, the frequency Hertz, dude's last name, okay? It's experimenting with different kind of waves, you know, in the mid-1800s. So a lot of people came together to eventually get to where Marconi got to.
Yeah.
But, you know, commercialized radio, or what we call radio voice, you know, he did mainly with it with telegraph signals. Let's be honest with that.
Well, yes.
But, you know, a lot of people came together. You know, Lee DeForest was one of them. And I always forget his first name, but Armstrong. Like, you'll see transmitters out there. His last name is Armstrong. He's the one who developed what we call FM today, back in the 30s and 40s. So, in him with Marconi and DeForest and David Sarnoff. Do you guys know who that is?
No.
He's the guy that started NBC.
Oh, nice.
So, he's the one who really took it from a radio network to a television network that we know today, David Sarnoff. So, he was, I believe, from Russia immigrants. He worked for the Marconi Wireless Company.
Okay.
He was one of the fastest, I guess, telegraphers. I guess that's what you call them. So he is what really turned what we, you know, call the wireless telegraph into voice, and then eventually what we see now is television.
And some amazing progress for the time, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, thinking, you know, even now, like, radio frequencies and just these invisible waves are still wonders of nature to this day. And just to think that people were actually that far involved with it back in the 1800s, it kind of seems mind-blowing in a sense that we would have that sort of technological mm-hmm. jump, and yet now it seems so analog.
It seems so old.
But yet it's still brilliant technology. I think that's why they said if like there was ever an apocalypse, that AM radio and ham radio is still, you know, that'll still be a thing because it's simply brilliant.
Disasters are saving radio.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I mean, it is. Yeah, yeah. I mean, especially because it's easier to, you know, carry that around.
So, of course, Marconi, you know, gets the first transatlantic signal sent to him. Do you know who sent the signal?
Was it some boat in the middle of the Atlantic?
Reginald Aubrey Fessenden.
Oh, yeah.
Who was also the first one to broadcast on a Christmas day and played O Holy Night.
Oh.
Using a weather vane as an antenna.
Wow.
So there you go. That guy was a pioneer in AM radio. So that's how he
was. Well, it wasn't AM. It still was just radio.
Well, I know, yeah. but it was still, you know, amplitude modulation. So
it's so weird in science. Like you were saying, you know, there's always a series. Where do you put the line of demarcation between when an invention began? Mm-hmm. You know, because it's built on discovery after discovery. But you've got these, you know, crackpots that are just hanging out in Canada playing around with wireless transmission. Which, by the way, transatlantic cable was laid in 1858. So like we're farther away from the invention of radio than they were from the transatlantic. That's crazy to me.
You know,
like from telegraph. Anyhow, but you got these crackpots that just like do their insane inventions, but it's the guys like Marconi who can get money. They can get funding that whose names actually end up on things,
like the Marconi Company.
Yeah.
I would also like to just make things a little more controversial for a second.
God. Okay.
By just saying that you just laid the perfect groundwork for President Barack Obama's comment of "you didn't build that" over businesses, because that was the perfect example there, my friend. When he made that comment, and everybody's like, "What do you mean I didn't build my business?" Blah blah blah. Well, you didn't build the telephone wires. You didn't build the interstate. You didn't build diesel combustion engines. But you use all these things for your business. And when that comment came out, and everybody got pissed about it. It's like, you know, that's what makes America great is the fact that somebody invents something, somebody else comes along, makes it better. Somebody else comes along, makes it better. It doesn't have to be a contest. Maybe we can all just be in this together, right?
But the hole I can see in that is there's a difference from government making a road than,
well,
you know,
yeah.
Because a lot of that was private. I mean, the FCC, what we call the FCC today, and first started as the Federal Radio Commission, didn't get involved until the airways were crowded. No one could get a signal there because everyone was, you know, playing around with it back then.
Yeah, but I mean, the government falls under the same scope, is that somebody else laid the groundwork for the next person. And that's just, you know, and that's why we have to think about the next generation beyond us too and not be so short-sighted sometimes, is because the actions we take now affect the next generation and so on and so forth. And, you know, like I said, it was a controversial statement, but it's supposed to be unifying. And I think that's kind of the point. And I think the radio discussion we just had is a great example of that.
We get sidetracked so deep anytime anyone brings up terrestrial radio. I'm gonna,
that's because we're radio guys.
I know.
Yeah. And but, now it's even worse because you got a third one in here, too. So.
I know. You're welcome. I know.
We talked for like 45 minutes about satellite radio.
Yeah, that was stupid.
It
was an awful podcast.
You put a satellite up in the sky, you see, and then beam it back down to
the
earth.
And you can say the F word.
That's true.
But I want to close this out with insulting Italians, because I can only name two Italian scientists, and that's Marconi and Enrico Fermi.
We are just checking off the boxes
here's kind of the funny thing, though, is that, you know, Marconi, of course, developed radio telegraphy, and he you know, did all of these really great things, and he is still somebody that we remember to this day. Especially those of us that work in radio because of the Marconi Awards.
But you don't know who Lee DeForest is or David Sarnoff.
Oh, shut up. Like, seriously, I'm horrible with names anyway. So that's the point. I remember tons of other crap.
There's a good I'm not a big Ken Burns PBS documentary person, but there is a good one called The Empire of the Air. You can get it on iTunes. I have it. It's really good. It's about 2.5 hours long. Good about radio.
I will check that one out. I met him once, actually.
They talk about the whole thing.
Yeah, I met him once, and that was a highlight.
Ken Burns or McCartney?
Ken Burns.
Marconi.
I did not meet Marconi.
Did you twist his arm and tell him that if he doesn't do a documentary on hockey, that
no,
you're going to break it?
But I will flat out admit this. I at least watch the Civil War documentary once a year.
Okay.
The entire series, at least once a year. Because it's one of the most brilliant things I've ever come across. So, there you go. Let's go ahead and move on up. Can anyone predict what I'm about to say?
Yes.
Yep. Something?
Mm-hmm.
I predict that in 1940... which happened in the past.
It did.
Wow. Post-diction.
My grandma was there.
A woman was born that would change the face of late-night infomercials forever.
And I think she was born in New Jersey.
She also sang a couple of songs. But her name was Ms. Dionne Warwick. So, Dionne Warwick, of course, born in East Orange, New Jersey. And very famous for the multiple songs that she did with Burt Bacharach and other people, of course, with Walk On By being another one. Say a Little Prayer for You, or Me, You, Me, I, which is Say a Little Prayer for Me, You.
No, You.
You.
I say
That's
a
right.
little prayer for you.
Is it bad that I'm, is it bad that I was trying to play it back in my head from my best
heart.
Friend's wedding?
Yes.
Because
yes,
that's the scene bad. I remember from whatever.
So
yes, Dionne Warwick. Then, of course, later on, after all of that fame, goes on to be basically the spokesperson for the psychic telephone network or whatever.
Psychic telephone. Oh, the late night infomercial.
Yes. And so she was like, psychics.
And they tell two friends.
Psychics are
so
waiting
on.
To talk
like
to you now.
It's a marketing scam.
I don't remember. I forgot the name of it. But yes, she flat out became the
Psychic Friends Network.
The Psychic Friends Network. That is correct. Thank you.
So do you know what's interesting? It says here she was born in East Orange, New Jersey.
Yes.
Do you know what's great about that?
No.
East Orange with Marconi. That's where the first radio tower was ever built.
Boom.
Hey.
That's a connection right there.
And guess what?
Ben, I'm having you back on
and
again.
Guess what?
This is great.
Guess what? It's still there today and it's broadcasting 2 FM signals.
Wow. I'm assuming
and
they've had
a,
to replace
an,
it at some point.
It's in a two-tier
so.
T shape. It's like two crosses on each other. It's a really cool tower.
Yeah, I'm going to look
that one up. It's a self-standing tower. Self-standing tower.
Hmm. Interesting.
But
let's go ahead
I
and move
I forgive
on.
Dionne Warwick for her helping shysters shice people out of money.
Yeah.
Because she's just like, she's like music royalty, man.
Yes, but at the same time, she was part of the Psychic Friends Network.
Yeah, well.
Which became
so,
a joke.
Well,
so.
Why do they never win the lottery?
Because they're not supposed to use their powers for evil. Everybody knows that.
Well, according to those holiday
That's not how
lottery
it works.
Commercials
I can't predict that.
On the radio, apparently it's a good idea.
Somebody would say that psychic already has. You just don't know.
I'll tell you why they don't. They don't because they're too busy hearing a name that starts with a J, a D, or a T.
it's a female presence.
Okay, I got one.
I'm seeing they're wearing a dress.
No,
usually no. That's somebody else. Let's see. No,
they have an address.
Who is that
they
guy?
They have an address.
Who was the guy that had that TV show in like the 90s?
Oh, there's
you know
too
who
many
I was
people.
Talking about.
There are too many people.
South Park did an episode
yeah,
on it.
That's true.
I think I got lost. What are we talking about?
I don't know.
It doesn't matter because we're about
let's
to
go
talk
ahead and move on. So go ahead,
about
Greg.
The queen of rhythm.
Well, yeah, that is true. In 1957, Sheila E. is born. Sheila Escovedo in...
Escovedo.
Oh, Escovedo. I don't speak Spanish, unfortunately.
Or Escovedo.
Well, nonetheless, she was born as Sheila in Oakland, California.
That's probably why she started going as Sheila E. because it's... Like, Sheila E., everyone!
Yep. Back from a simpler time when we just didn't care to learn.
So I do like Sheila E. for just one simple reason. She is one of the few, like, female percussionists that actually, like, did good and, like, became, like, famous for it. The great joke, of course, being from the movie The School of Rock, where they say, it's like, you know, name one, it's like girl who can drum. And she goes, Sheila E. and Meg White from the White Stripes. And he's just like, it's like, Meg White can't drum. Sorry, that was a whole.
Yeah, School of Rock, that's right.
Oh, yes. It's just funny that, like, that's basically the only two female drummers that anybody can reference is Sheila E. and Meg White from the White Stripes.
You know what? Love Sheila E.
There is the drummer from the Donnas, too. She's freaking great.
That's what I was thinking, and I was like, that's not the same person, is it?
No.
Like, I don't know.
But the Donnas is like one of those like more obscure bands that most people don't really like know about.
I think everybody heard Take It Off, at least.
Yeah, that's true.
But I wanna take it off.
Yeah, that's a good band, though. I got a couple of friends that are really big into the Donnas. But let's go ahead and move on to the next little fact.
1970.
Jake.
In New Orleans, Jim Morrison and the Doors
pulled his dick out.
No, last show.
Oh, look at that.
Yes, and the last song of the night was somewhat abbreviated. It was Light My Fire. Why was it abbreviated? Because Morrison was fucked out of his head and could not continue the show.
Come on, baby, light my fire.
Yeah, he just kind of quit halfway through one verse, and the band just kind of played it out. And
according to this, he died like 7 months later.
Yeah, but he kind of disappeared for a while there.
So.
Kind of evading prosecution for a while.
Yeah.
Also, so.
So he went to France, which is where
to avoid extradition.
Where he ended up dying, and that's where he is buried to this, you know, now. So at least that's believed. So.
Well, this is a great segue to our next one.
In 2007... Ike Turner, the man, the myth, the deplorable human being, died of cocaine overdose in San Marcos, California at the age of 76, which is amazing that he actually lived that long in the first place. He was struggling with emphysema and cardiovascular disease, and so he thought, you know what, my heart should probably have some more cocaine. So then he did it, and he died. So, there you go.
He sounds like the grandpa from Little Miss Sunshine who says, I'm old. I can do whatever I want. Who cares?
So, of course, Ike Turner, famous for saying he invented rock and roll, which is a total lie, because we all know Chuck Berry did.
It's no more a lie than Bo Diddley saying he invented rock and roll.
Or Al Gore invented the internet.
Yeah, but Bo Diddley also claimed that he invented the 3-2 beat.
The Hambone rhythm?
He claimed he invented that. It's not like Latin music had been doing that for the last 80 plus years.
Yeah, isn't that like a classic bossa nova?
Yeah. Hmm.
Also, I'm pretty sure that...
Usually done with the claves.
If you take a class, they force you to call that polyrhythm.
No, that's not what they call it.
Well, Ike Turner and Chuck Berry, both with St. Louis Walk of Fame stars.
That is true.
You know what, though? Ike Turner does have a claim, though, to inventing rock and roll, because he produced, like... a lot of the early stuff.
I'm just saying, Chuck Berry invented rock and roll.
Ah, man. You know what, Brian? We're going to do an episode where we, like, arm wrestle to decide who invented rock and roll. And I'll argue that Hank Williams did.
Make sure you get it on video.
No, that's not good. No.
Who invented rock and roll?
Hank Williams did not invent rock and roll.
We'll just have to arm wrestle.
Did not invent, no.
It's Hank Williams.
Let's move on to December 13th.
Guy's an asshole.
Greg, all for you.
Well, this one is a special little treat because the beloved actor and entertainer Dick Van Dyke was born in this year, 1925, in West Plains, Missouri. But he grew up and is known for claiming his hometown of Danville, Illinois, where to this day they still celebrate Dick Van Dyke Day. He stars and sings in the hit musical Mary Poppins and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, featuring the famous title song, and during that Dick Van Dyke Day parade in Danville, he rides in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang down Main Street.
So I'm going to tell you this, though. His whole thing in Mary Poppins is pretty horrible, though, because that's like one of the worst British accents ever done on film.
His performance is good, though.
His performance is good.
It's camp.
Horrible.
It's horrible. Camp and it's good.
Accent.
I disagree. I disagree thoroughly.
It's like one of the worst Cockney accents ever done.
Where is your sense of whimsy?
Have you heard what American accents sound like on the BBC these days?
No.
They're awful.
Nah.
They're just as bad as his British accent.
I don't know, man.
Because anytime they're like, all right, just do an American woman, they do a Valley Girl.
Oh, like, right, how y'all doing, y'all?
No, that's a Southern girl, oh, not right. a Valley girl.
With the Valley.
That's
the
Valley's that's like, the male
like,
one.
Like, oh my God, did you see what she was wearing?
Gag me with a spoon.
Girl. Yeah, it's Valley Girl.
And that was perfect.
No, it literally came from the Valley in California.
Oh my God.
And popularized by a song from Frank Zappa's daughter, Moon Unit Zappa, called Valley Girl.
Yep.
So was she drinking like a pumpkin spice latte and hug boots?
Well, that came much, much later on, but yes.
Yeah. No, they would have been.
No, I'm talking about for the BBC.
Okay, in the 90s.
I went to Target over the weekend. I literally saw four girls dressed exactly alike walking together with Starbucks mugs and our cups. And I was just like,
I got to call the BBC.
I hate living in this world.
At any time that they have like a British guy doing an American accent, a man's accent, they always start out just going, all right, hey, Jack.
Hey, Jack.
That's always like Jack or Joe. Or they always start out by, listen, Joe.
Hey there, Joe.
Like, who the... No, I've never walked up to anyone.
I'm telling you, though.
I'll take a cheeseburger and some fries, Pilgrim.
There are a couple of Brits, though. He goes, let me tell you how my morning was, Joe. Never.
Either way,
Pilgrim. Too?
Can we get back to Dick Van Dyke?
Yes, we can.
Either way, Dick Van Dyke, happy birthday.
He's still alive, right?
Yes, dick slinging.
He is.
Dick slinging?
Yes. Do you know how old his wife is?
He's hanging in
there.
He's
like in his 90s, right?
Yes, he is in his 90s. He is currently like 93. His wife, 45.
Really? Who's his wife?
His wife was his makeup girl on just a set.
So he got, he.
He started flirting with her. Yes. Oh. Well, he was married for a long time, and he was a widower for like 15 years.
Oh, well.
And he was married to his first wife. 48 to 84.
I could totally make a good sex joke with his name with this and what you're saying, but, you know, I'm just going to leave that to the imagination.
Dude, Dick Van Dyke is a baller.
I ain't saying she a gold digger.
But Richard Van Dyke.
His brother's still around, too, Jerry Van Dyke. Star of My Mother the Car.
Well,
anyway.
Either way, let's go ahead and move on to the next
one. I love old people that just don't quit, like Ike Turner, Dick Van Dyke.
And Betty White.
And Betty White. God damn
it. I love Betty White. I know we're totally getting off topic, but I love me some Betty White.
That's perfectly fine. Right. Jake.
Yes.
You got one for us.
Yeah, somebody who I kind of wish would quit. 1948. Ted Nugent is born Theodore Anthony Nugent in Detroit, Michigan.
The Motor City Madman.
Yeah.
Of course, Detroit.
Now he's well known for hunting.
Hunting.
And hunting.
No, and just being a talking
and
head on
fringe
Fox News.
And political commentary.
If that's what you want to call it. I just think shouting. But
he had a reality TV show called Surviving Nugent.
Really?
There are some people who swear by Ted Nugent. Like, they think that he's one of the greatest things ever.
Chuck Norris.
We work with one of those individuals who praises Ted Nugent.
It's Chuck. You cannot compare Chuck Norris to Ted Nugent. Despite the fact that they are both conservatives. Chuck Norris is the man.
Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris apparently has a fist comes out of his beard.
Chuck Norris is super fit still and like can still kick people.
Chuck Norris.
Ted Nugent can just like, you know, shoot an arrow.
And not only that, but Walker Texas Ranger reruns still get higher ratings than Ted Nugent's show ever did.
All right.
That's true.
All right.
That's a true statement right there.
Really be honest here.
Go for it.
Chuck Norris is the Ned Flanders of the martial arts world.
So?
And Ted Nugent still thinks he's 22. I think he's winning at life.
But. Here's what I would like to point out, and this will settle this completely, and that is Chuck Norris once read some of the Chuck Norris facts, right? And when he got to the one that said Chuck Norris's tears cure cancer, but Chuck Norris has never cried, he flat out said, if my tears did cure cancer, I'd cry all the time.
Aww.
Man, he is the
best. He's a good man.
He is the best person
ever. Ted Nugent would be like, if my tears cured cancer, I'd shoot him.
Why in the hell is Chuck Norris not running for office?
Because he's Chuck Norris. He's got better things to do.
Gosh, he's got... Damn you and your standards.
He's got to sell the total body gyms, you know?
He could at least run for senator.
That's true.
Right?
That guy's head is made out
of
wood.
Hell, you should point him to...
I would not want him.
Best abs 2020.
You should point him to the Supreme Court.
No, seriously, you know what? He couldn't do any more damage.
Anyone can be appointed. You don't have to be a lawyer.
That is true.
That is true.
But you have to be confirmed either way. So, sorry, Ted. I don't really like you either.
Decent music.
Right. Like, I mean, you did some cool stuff, but you were the wild man, you know. It's like, I get it.
I'd like him more if he stuck to just talking about hunting.
But I'm just saying, like, of all the Detroit, like, artists that came out of there, like, you're pretty low on my list, Ted.
You know,
sorry.
It's kind of weird, too, because he used to be the Motor City Madman, but now he's, like, the opposite of Detroit, you know, because he's all country and hunting and... You know, kind of the backwoods
and Detroit's
kind of
all
attitude.
Hipsters,
and not only that, but he probably loves.
I'd like to point
Detroit.
Out though that he is absolutely like Northern Michigan. Like that's all it is up there is just you know hunting.
That's
and
what
fishing
I'm saying
and,
is, you know, it's like coming from St. Louis and then being all like, oh, you know, I'm from tiny little nowhere town in the middle of the, you know, and it's like, well, you're from Detroit, man. You know, like, I don't know. Anyways,
I thought you were going to point out how Detroit has changed in the last, like, 50 years.
Well, that's what I said, is that he probably loathes Detroit, too. Yeah. He would not get elected in Detroit. He might get elected in Michigan, but he would not get elected.
That is true.
Detroit.
All right, moving on up to 1967. Got a real quick one for you here. At the Shrine Exhibition Hall in Los Angeles, the Grateful Dead performed Dark Star for the first time. And there you go.
Wow, that was quick. Wow. Unlike Dark Star, which turns into like a 45-minute jam session.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of Grateful Dead songs turn into 45-minute jam sessions. But I actually gained a much greater appreciation for the Grateful Dead in this last year because I listened to some of their stuff, and it reminded me a lot of the band, and I'm a huge fan of the band, but it was definitely a lot more mellow. And like when they're controlled in their songs, I love it. When they turn into a jam band, that's when I'm like, nope, I'm done with this.
I will say, too, that
I can't stand jam bands anymore. It's like two songs into a jam band. I'm like, I got it. You're good musicians. Move on.
It takes a few years to get acclimated to jam band music, you know?
Yep. True. Completely true. That, and since I'm not like in any kind of, I'm not a stoner in any capacity. And so for me, like, a lot of the guys that I hear who go to these things, that's basically what they do. They show up, they get high, and they listen to the music as these people jam out. I'm like, that holds no appeal for me. As a musician, that means nothing. So,
well, maybe you should do some drugs.
That's not going to happen.
That was a joke.
But moving on to the weird story of the night, being read by the one and only Ben Schaefer.
Where's my music?
I don't
Bieber
have
balls. I'm going to claim this as Bieber balls.
Go for it.
Let's go. It's
so on December. How do you turn this off?
I wanted to
right,
give him
fade
a name
that out,
too.
Jake.
Bieber balls, Ben. Take
no,
it away.
Bieber balls, Ben. Just Bieber balls. So December 13th, 2012. Police bust a bizarre murder plot targeting pop star Justin Bieber, a team of three men in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I was like, what else goes on there, I guess? Had been making plans to stalk and kill the singer and even castrate him. Why castrate him? I mean, honestly, a lot of people probably want to do that too.
Locker
right?
room talk.
One of the three men had reportedly been obsessed with Bieber to the point of having a tattoo of him on his leg. All three men were apprehended along with confiscated weapons and a set of pruning shears. So what are we going to prune?
Well, it seems apparent to me that the individual with the Bieber tattoo was probably looking for a keepsake.
Here's the one thing that I kind of am wondering
his
about.
His balls
that.
Are delicate.
Like,
so you have to...
was this like old school Bieber, like baby?
Well, it's 2012, five
like,
years ago.
I'm just saying, or it's like, so if he had like a tattoo of like young teen
during the whole
Justin
baby,
Bieber,
baby.
Yeah, that's even creepier.
Oh, yeah.
Especially if he wanted to castrate him.
I well, think.
2012, he would have been like 18, I believe. But go ahead, Jake.
Where's the creepiest place to tattoo somebody's face on your body?
Your ass.
Yeah, I was going to say probably your butt.
Really?
Probably.
No, because that could be done ironically, you know.
I think so. I think like in your like right on your chest, so like every time you look
or just right on your little dingling too.
Well, I was going to say
like
the area just above.
Ooh. The Brad Pitt area.
So if like, every time he like Brad you know Pitt gets area. Naked or something, yeah. It's like there's just Justin Bieber on his upper thigh.
I don't want to say this, but I'm going to say it. But if you tattooed him perfectly mm-hmm. so that Bieber could grow a beard over the years,
yeah.
just right there above your crotch.
Mm-hmm.
No. Oh, that's so wrong.
And then you could call it like the Bieber.
And then you can prune
you know.
It with the shears.
Yeah.
Oh, Lordy.
Speaking of, okay.
Let's jump to the next.
Yeah, hang on. Right, wait. Public service announcement.
Go ahead.
If you're going to castrate someone,
which, you know, the thought has crossed
everyone's mind at some point, I just want to exhort everyone to please use professional equipment. And I would like to suggest the Henderson Equine Castrating Instrument, as it minimizes swelling, bleeding, and risk of infection.
And how often do you do that?
It's a good clean cut. Jacob's probably castrated at least one animal in his life.
Why would you say that? I've never...
In how many humans?
Well, I mean... Zero.
I was thinking more in practical terms.
In practical terms.
Well, you can come up with the show idea. There you go.
You know what? I am way too much of a procrastinator to actually castrate any... I'd be like, yeah, I'll get to it tomorrow.
I was going
to
say, you know, you can't pass judgment here, because if you've ever owned a goat farm, this is probably like a day-to-day right. thing for you.
Oh, sure. I'm for sure, yeah. I don't own.
We know somebody who owns.
That's why I gasp. I'm like, I look like a goat farmer. I got to work on my image.
Well, and I think goats make it a lot easier than Bieber would.
We know somebody who raises sheep and stuff, and basically, the males she lets grow up and then just slaughters them. So keeps the females. So there you go.
I mean, yeah, just go ahead and kill them if you're. If you're gonna castrate them, just kill them.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and jump on over to December 14th.
I don't know what I'm talking about.
1959.
Say this one right.
Okay.
It's important.
All right.
How you say it.
Okay, hold on. December 14th, 1959, the Ohio State University Research Center issues a report showing that rock and roll is the overwhelming favorite music of people aged 14 to 18. However, most of the age 18 who were polled considered it their least favorite form of music. So there is your dividing line.
Wow.
So in 1959, anyone who was 18 had probably grown up with a certain style of music. And so right there, that's the dividing line for the adults.
I thought that like the day you turn 18 was the day you started saying, you damn kids and your rock and roll.
But that's what they said. Most over the age of 18 considered it their least favorite. So that, like, literally right there, 1959, 18 plus hated rock and roll, 18 down loved it.
I see what you're saying. Like
born before 55.
Yeah, you literally pinpointed where the turn came from, essentially.
Where the generational turn was, right there.
Yeah, but all music is that. So, like, today with Justin Bieber, for an example, you know, like my dad says, well, that's not, you know, music, you know, Aerosmith and all the other stuff or whatever they play on
KSHE
is. Well,
that's the thing is that...
To me, that seems like the same thing there. It's a generation
The debate
thing.
Between real and fake music is one that will continue for generations to come. And that's because every generation likes what they like, and then the next generation comes along and likes what they like, and the previous generation doesn't like that. Because it's not what they had.
And that's going to happen to all of
us. It's going to happen to everyone. The difference is that I'd like to think that I'm a bit more open-minded, and I like a lot of like pop music that comes out. It's just at the same time, I'm not going to listen to it. Like, I'm not going to purchase it. I'll listen to it on the radio. I'll listen to it, you know, if it's like in a movie or something like that. But for the most part, I'm not going to purchase a Justin Bieber album, despite the fact that he could write a song that I actually like.
The only...
I take that back. He could pay someone to write a song that I might actually like.
The only 2 cents I'll throw in on this, though, is that one of the greatest bands ever, greatest song ever by the greatest band ever, Rush, Spirit of the Radio. I bring this up every time when people talk about what's good music and what isn't good music, because in their song they said, all this machinery making modern music can still be open-hearted. Not so coldly charted. It's really just a question of your honesty. And they go on, you know, one likes to believe in the freedom of music, but glittering prizes and endless compromises shatter the illusion of integrity. Anyways, the point is, if someone puts out music and says it's music, it is, in a sense, music. And there's there's a million different ways to get to the end point, which is music.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you're honest with yourself...
Yeah.
Then no one has any right to say that it's not music or that it's terrible or it's not real.
For me, it's always about that crucial thing of honesty in music.
Integrity.
Yes. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of pop stars don't get that from the previous generation. And that's because, you know, they grew up in a world where, I mean, you want to talk about Aerosmith. Aerosmith wrote all of their stuff. You know, Steven Tyler is a guy who can write songs. Like, he's a very talented wordsmith. But, you know, you fast forward, you have an artist like Beyonce that everybody worships, apparently, and yet she doesn't write her own stuff.
Nope, yeah. That would be Sia.
She pays a bunch of other people to write for her. She pays a bunch of producers to, you know, make the music, who they in turn pay a bunch of musicians to record the stuff, and then so on and so forth. It's like while, you know, there could be elements of realness in that music, it's subdued because there's all of this other stuff attached to it. And yet, like, I go back to this constantly. When Kanye West told Beck that he should give up his Grammy Award and give it to a real artist like Beyonce, and I just wanted to, like, slap him around and be like, you do realize that Beck basically made that entire album by himself.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't he do that to Taylor Swift, too?
He did it. Well, Taylor Swift is, you know, the same, same thing, just, you know, different boat. So,
well,
same sea, different boat.
So
Beck was off, like, doing something completely insane off in the middle of nowhere. And yet, you know, he's not a real artist like Beyonce.
But speaking of generation gaps, what I would like to see is when I'm 80 and these songs about...
When I'm 84?
You know, like these songs like, oh, we're effing these, you know, bitches or whatever. It's like, this is the music I grew up, grandchildren.
But, yeah. But, you know...
I still like to, you know, it's like in the future, hey, I found a picture of grandma and it's an Instagram photo of some girl in a bikini doing duck face.
Yeah. Well, I think the moral of the story is that you can take an artist like Skrillex,
mm-hmm.
who completely sits down and puts together his stuff, his compositions, and plays them. Now, granted, he uses samples, but he is creating something. It could be legitimately argued that he is more of an artist than Beyonce.
See, and here's something that I really want to point out, because we're going to go to the next one here, too. And that is, we've talked about this before, but I can complain all I want about Beyonce not writing her own music and doing that kind of stuff. But Greg, go ahead and give us the next fact.
Hang on.
That was a perfect freaking transition.
It was, though, but I want to point out Chuck Berry's genius, because he knew this before the Ohio State researchers did.
Okay.
Like, you look at his songs. He writes all these songs about kids and mm-hmm. how they're his audience.
Yes.
Roll Over Beethoven. I'm going to write a little letter. Send it to my local DJ. All right, fine. You know what? Your transition was too amazing. I'll move over like Tchaikovsky.
I get it. All right.
Okay, so you guys may recall earlier I mentioned in 1961, Motown Records scored their first number one hit with the Marvelettes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, flash forward to the year 1968, when Motown has officially taken hold. Motown acts hold the top three spots on the Hot 100 in just a few years later. Number one, I Heard It Through the Grapevine by Marvin Gaye. Number two, Love Child by the Supremes. And number three, For Once in My Life by Stevie Wonder. So from 61, where they get their first number one hit, to 68, where they are dominating the charts.
Mm-hmm.
The chart stays the same the next week. And a week later, Stevie and the Supremes trade positions. So, I mean, not only did they hold it, but they had a firm, almost monopoly on the music at the time.
So here's the point that I was trying to get to before. I can go after Beyonce for not writing any of her stuff, but most of the Motown catalog wasn't written by those artists.
Mm-hmm.
It was written by either people that they had there, like Smokey Robinson, or it was written by people who basically sold the songs to them. And then if they liked it, they purchased it and then had an artist record it. And then usually they'd even have multiple artists record it and then figure out which one that they thought had the best sound for it. But later on down here, like Heard It Through the Grapevine, it wasn't written by Smokey Robinson. And Stevie Wonder was already writing all of his own stuff anyway at like the age of 13. you know, that's just because he's a musical genius. But it's one of those things, too, where Motown had their method, and they knew full well what they were doing in trying to write hits. That's why they had, you know, these focus groups where they would play songs for them and try and find out which songs worked the best. Like, so, it's like I said, I can fault Beyonce for that. But if I'm going to apply the same standard to the whole of music, I got to do the same thing for Motown as well. But for me, Motown is always like a little bit less than that because, you know, it's Motown.
Yeah.
Like, they had that sound, you know, that was like very real and all of that with the Funk Brothers recording everything. And
well, there's so many variables that go into it.
Yes.
Because, you know, if you're taking the conversation we just had about mm-hmm. the integrity and then saying, okay, well, all these Motown artists, a lot of them were helped, and this was Motown was more of a hit making machine. It
yes.
was really a hit factory, mm-hmm. if you will, with an assembly line of sorts of people. You know, this guy does his job where he comes up with the hook, and
yes.
this guy picks the perfect person to sing it, and this guy, you know, and there's a whole team behind
mm-hmm.
it.
Exactly.
I think the only other variable to kind of work in their favor, though, was that this was still so early in the game that nowadays you see it as like a big company just putting out hits and, you know, trying to feed the people,
yeah.
you know, feed the masses. But in this case, they were kind of pioneering that.
That's true.
And I think that's the one variable that kind of throws a wrench in it, is because you want to say, well, look, you know, you were literally just, I mean, it's like Michael Bay in movies. You're just giving the people what they want, and you don't really care about anything else other than delivering exactly pristinely and crisply what the market wants.
True.
But at the same time, it was new. It was hot.
Yes.
And not only that, but Michael Bay makes a lot of money. So.
True. But I will reiterate what I said before, and that is, if people can be honest in their art, then it doesn't really matter what other people think. And that's all I ever hope for from any artist that makes it big, is that what they are singing is something that is honest for them.
It's rule number one for art.
Yes. And if they're not, then I write them off as being insincere and fake.
Well, and the other great quote was Dave Grohl when he was talking about American Idol and stuff. He says, these singing shows, you get on the show, everybody who gets on the show is already a great singer or performer,
mm-hmm.
you know, 9 times out of 10, and they have to earn that respect and the votes of everybody to actually become American Idol. Dave Grohl said, hell, if I was in that, Nirvana never would have happened.
Yep.
Because they just went in their garage and played music and did what they wanted to do as artists. And if we were voting, they would have never made it to Hollywood.
Yep.
You know?
That is true.
We would have never gotten Kurt Cobain. So.
Or the Foo Fighters.
Yeah. I mean, it's just food for thought.
Let's go ahead and move on to our last day, December 15th.
Mm-hmm.
Jake, what do you got?
The strange and interesting disappearance of a very ordinary aircraft. 1944, a UC-64 Norseman airplane numbered USAAF.
United States Army Air Force.
44-70285 disappears over the English Channel en route to Paris, France. On board is pilot airman John Morgan, Lieutenant Colonel Norman Basil, and Major Glenn Miller of the Glenn Miller Band.
Yes.
What?
No,
yes. Not the same guy.
Now, on September 27th, 1942, the Glenn Miller Band played their last show. Band leader Glenn Miller, at age 38, joined the Army after writing to Brigadier General Charles Young. In his letter, he cited his willingness to serve in whatever way that he could. Now, initially, he was sent down to Montgomery, Alabama, at the Maxwell Field Proving Grounds. He played trombone in a 15-piece band, but he had bigger aspirations. He wanted to overhaul and reorganize the entire U.S. Army, or excuse me, the entire all armed services bands. He started this by starting a radio program on a local show. It was just kind of recruitment focused propaganda.
Yeah.
The show was called I Support the Wings, and it interviewed civil service women, or women in the civil service, that worked at Maxwell Field. But he had the audacity to play jazz, which really upset the brass.
Of course it did.
Because the Army at that time was really ruled by tradition. And deviating from the doctrine of military bands play marches was kind of like unthinkable. People didn't want it. However, Miller's talent won out, and eventually he was sent to New York City so that he could modernize the musical war machine in a bigger market. It was here where Miller offered up his entire back catalog of music to the war effort, which included 1941's biggest hit, In the Mood.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to separate In the Mood from just normal Americana and what it did for the USO. Walt Disney did a tune with it that, like, I think when you hear ba-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da, ba-ba, ba-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da, ba-ba, you either think of a USO show or the Walt Disney, like, you know, war propaganda. By 1944, Miller was in command of a 50-piece band that he had handpicked from the entire U.S. Armed Forces.
Mm-hmm.
They began making recordings that were broadcast on, you know, U.S. Army military radio, and then they would do new arrangements of old marches and jazz them up,
mm-hmm.
which I loved diving in and listening to that last night. It's really good stuff. So the band was moved to England so that they could become part of the BBC's propaganda machine,
mm-hmm.
and they did that. However, while they were there, they also started playing USO shows. And in 1944, so from the spring of 1944 up to November, they played over 800 USO shows.
Wow.
That's insanity.
That's a lot of shows.
That's crazy to me. Hardworking guy there, Glenn Miller. But the plan was to go to France and set up shop over there.
Mm-hmm.
Because you follow the front line, right?
Yep.
Now, Glenn Miller, I just read this morning, or today at lunch, he moved out. He was in the BBC building and moved out the same day a V-1 rocket hit the BBC.
Of course.
Whoa.
And killed 70 people. So, fortunate that day, not so fortunate the next day because his plane disappeared en route to Paris. So, Miller, 1944, didn't get to see V-Day, either VE or VJ Day. He didn't see the end of the war. But he was posthumously given a Bronze Star for his service. And, yeah.
Wow. That's quite the story. So the first thing that really stood out to me was that this guy's, like, ambition was to completely revamp strictly the armed forces' musical taste.
Yes.
And that's interesting. That's very interesting to me. I guess the only thought I can really have is that somebody was kind of just making the best of a situation, you know, where he gets into the military, but you also love music, and you say to yourself, you know what, let's spice this up a little bit. Because besides that, how niche, you know?
Jazz came out of the U.S. Armed Forces bands. It was what they were playing when they were just practicing and fooling around themselves.
I know. I keep thinking of, like, the little bugle boy from Company B
thing. Yeah. That song is a remix of In the Mood.
Really?
They use Glenn Miller's back catalog of music for so much USO stuff that you go back and start listening to some of it, and you're like, oh, yeah, I remember the Andrews Sisters doing a tune to this song. Mm-hmm. I remember Bob Hope doing jokes over this piece of music. It's, you know what? There's a Ken Burns documentary there that hasn't been made yet.
Right. it sounds like a really interesting story, though, behind the whole thing. And, you know, also, you're saying 800 shows in such a short amount of time. The only catch is that I wonder how difficult it is to plan a world tour when you're involved in the armed forces. I feel like it just lends itself to a world tour, you know?
Well, that was all in England. 800 shows in England. Like, they were flying.
What?
Yes.
So
they would go up to Birmingham and play for these guys. And then they would go over here and play for those guys. Yeah, they would play, like, three shows for some civil service guys. Then they'd run down to the docks and play a show in the same town.
So they played like every single city in England, essentially. I mean,
yeah, I guess. I mean,
because here I'm thinking like, oh, they got troops in France and they're doing a show in France. They got troops, you know, in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And so they crossed.
No, they couldn't move too far from the BBC because that's where they were doing recordings that were getting sent out and broadcast to the troops.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Very, very driven individual. I didn't realize his ambition, you know, because like that's what I was getting at was if there's troops, you know, like modern day, if there's troops in Afghanistan, we send people to Afghanistan, it makes sense, blah, blah, blah. But
So somebody has actually put together sort of a likely timeline of what happened with Glenn Miller's plane.
Okay.
They said that there was poor visibility, so they were flying low. Unfortunately, it was also extremely cold out at the time, and they believe that part of the fuel line and fuel tank ended up freezing, which stopped fuel from going to the engine, which shut the engine off and gave them about 8 seconds to react due to their height. Said the plane was built out of lightweight materials, probably when it went into the water, disintegrated on impact, and killed everyone on board instantly. This is the believed theory. There was a proposed theory that they were shot down by friendly fire, which was completely false. Like, that's been disproven. But since there was never any wreckage of the plane found, nobody really knows what actually happened.
Ooh. Creepy.
They didn't find anything of the plane. Nothing. So, I mean, but it's a big ocean. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's bound to happen.
I mean, it's 2017. We're still looking for planes.
And that's the thing. You know? Since the plane was probably made out of wood, like, they might find some metal parts, but like the engines or something. But for the most part, the plane itself would probably have been scattered over a very large area. So,
wow.
There's an alternate history novel just like waiting to get written about how he was saved by, like, him and Leon Trotsky. Like, Trotsky survived assassination, and him and Glenn Miller were trotting around the Soviet Union trying to, you know, restart the October Revolution. I don't know.
I feel like there's a conspiracy there that he actually came to the United States and became Tupac Shakur.
Yeah, Glenn Miller is Tupac. I love it.
I mean, why not? Let's just go off the deep end. Hey, actually, you know, a better segue would have been that he came back as Elvis.
You know what?
So.
Because.
Closing out the show, I thought this was a very fitting way to do it. But we're only going up to 1956 for December 15th, and it goes a little something like this. In 1956, Elvis was giving his final performance at a certain location on Louisiana Hayride when Horace Logan said the now legendary phrase, "Elvis has left the building."
Boom!
And the rest is music history. It is still a phrase that is said today if somebody leaves randomly. And like,
or Seacrest out.
Elvis has left the building. And on that note, I think we have concluded our episode of Music History, December 11th through December 15th. It was a lot of good stuff. We had a lot of good conversations. And if you want to help us out, of course, go to our website, click on that Amazon banner, or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. Also, check out the other great podcasts on lineupmedia.fm. Other great shows that you can go and listen to on there. Just tons of them. So, I have been your host, Brian Kroc, and along with me has been Greg Harvey.
Lady, you shot me.
And Ben Schaefer.
I don't have a snappy comeback line.
And Jacob Crum.
Foolish pride, that's all I have left.
Remember, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.